rubbed her aching back, digging her thumbs into the knotted muscles. She gazed along the ward at the rows of neatly made beds and admired her efforts. Her hospital corners could rival those of Florence Nightingale herself, and the 30 mattresses looked like expertly wrapped Christmas presents. She heard Pearl puffing behind her.
"Amy, there's two men come to see you. Here on ward."
Her eyes were wide with disbelief. Other than doctors and the occasional male visitor, this ward was not used to men putting in an appearance. "Thank you, Pearl. I'll be along shortly." Whilst appearing unfazed on the outside, she needed a minute to compose herself, taking deep breaths and running through what she was going to say in her head. Ed was standing at the end of the ward next to Nurse Lyons, who had his arms slung about his young charge's shoulder. The nurse smiled as he saw Amy approaching.
"This young man is on his way home and asked to say goodbye to you."
Amy stared at Ed. He was in his civilian clothes now, brown trousers that actually fitted him and didn't show off his ankles, and a green checked shirt open at the neck, his rolled-up sleeves showing his tanned arms. He fidgeted with the cap in his hands and looked down at the floor. "Please, Ed," she willed. "Just act normally. Don't give us away." "Hello, Ed," she said breezily. "I'm so glad you came to say goodbye." He looked up but didn't speak again. It was as though he didn't trust himself to say anything. "You look so smart. Ready to go home, I expect." He nodded silently. Was all he could manage. Amy noticed the way his eyes darted left and right. He couldn't have looked more shifty had he been dressed in a striped jersey with a balaclava on his head and a bag of swag over his shoulder. She needed to get him out.
"Well, it's been lovely getting to know you, Ed. All the best for the future, and take care on that bike of yours."
She gave a small laugh. He took a tentative step towards her, opened his arms, and gave her a hesitant hug. She pulled him closer, feeling his breath warm against her ear.
"See you tomorrow,"
he whispered.
"Are you all right?"
Belinda took the chair opposite Amy in the bay window and leaned forward, propping her fist under her chin as she asked her question. She gave the impression she actually cared about the answer. Amy looked up from her book. "Why shouldn't I be?"
"Well, I know how fond you were of that boy. Now he's gone. Thought you might be a bit sad."
Amy regarded Belinda through narrowed eyes and marvelled at how far they had come since they had first met, when they had hated each other on sight. "That's kind of you, Belinda, but I'm fine, honestly." This seemed to satisfy the other girl, who beamed her toothy smile.
"Grand, that is. You're so... oh, what's that word? You always seem to bounce back."
"Resilient," Amy supplied.
"Yeah, that's it. Wish I could be more like you."
"You're fine as you are, Belinda." Amy turned back to her book, indicating that the conversation was over. Belinda didn't seem to take the hint.
"Are you looking forward to the summer ball on Saturday?"
Amy stared at the words on the page as they merged into a mass of unintelligible letters.
"Yes, I suppose so.
Will you dance with me?"
The thought of taking Belinda's sweaty body into her arms was repulsive. Just sitting here, she could smell the ripe odour seeping from her pores.
"We'll see."
"You won't have that boy to dance with, will you?"
"That's true."
She turned over another page, keeping her head down.
"So you'll have time to dance with me, then?"
Amy slammed the book shut, making Belinda jump. She struggled to keep the impatience out of her voice. "I'm sure there will be plenty of young men willing to dance with you, Belinda." She knew nothing could be further from the truth. There would be plenty lining up for a quick fumble in exchange for the usual ciggies, but men willing to dance with her would be in short supply. She was too nervous to eat breakfast, but anxious not to arouse suspicion, she nibbled at the corner of a slice of toast. The greasy slick of margarine on top made her want to retch. She swilled down a cup of stewed tea and glanced at the clock on the wall. Only 2 more hours of this wretched existence to tolerate, and then she would be free. The knot of excitement in her chest made breathing difficult. She wiped away the dewy film of perspiration from her top lip, her fingers beating out an impatient rhythm on the table. Sister Atkins appeared behind her with a clipboard and prodded her in the back.
You, change of plan. Get yourself down to the laundry.
Amy swiveled round to face her. But I'm on beds this week.
And now you're on laundry.
Sister Atkins pulled the chair out, causing Amy to stumble to her feet.
Move it!
Amy forced herself to calm down. She could still go through with the plan. It would just mean coming up with an excuse to leave the laundry and find her way across to the other side of the hospital where she had planned to meet Ed. Turn left out of the main gate, he'd instructed, then first right, and he would be waiting in the bus shelter. There would be much more ground to cover now, but as long as she wasn't missed before she'd had the chance to make it through the gate, everything would be all right. Ed would have a change of clothes for her. As he'd pointed out, walking out of an unlocked gate was quite straightforward, but patients in their communal garb with the amber gate insignia stitched into the pocket could hardly be inconspicuous in the wider community. She made her way along the ward, a thousand scenarios going round in her head. She glanced over at her own unmade bed, the taut corners at the bottom still unruffled. She felt a curious sense of pride. She stopped at Belinda's bed, where the other girl was tearing through her hair with a brush that was next to useless on her thick, matted locks.
"Goodbye, Belinda."
The catch in her throat caught her by surprise, and she swallowed hard as she pasted a smile on her face. Belinda frowned.
"I'll see you at lunchtime, won't I?"
Amy hesitated.
"Yes, yes, of course you will."
A doubtful look spread across Belinda's face. She didn't believe a word of it.
"Where are you going, Amy?"
she asked.
"To the laundry."
Belinda threw the brush down on her bed.
"I meant after that. When you get out."
Amy put her finger to her lips.
"Shh! What do you mean?"
"You've been acting very strange since your boyfriend left."
"I'm right, aren't I? You're going over at war."
Amy licked her lips, taking time to formulate an answer. She could either flatly deny it or take Belinda into her confidence. She looked at the girl's forlorn expression, her puppy dog eyes and pouting mouth. "I'm not going anywhere." She took hold of Belinda's hand and gave it a light squeeze. "I promise, I'll see you later."
"Good," said Belinda, "because I couldn't bear it in here without you."
Chapter 37. The laundry was the place to be in winter. The hot, steamy atmosphere and the comforting smell of the warm linen were certainly preferable to the noisy kitchens. In the summer, though, it was unbearable. As soon as Amy pushed the door open, the rush of heat hit her in the face. It was as though she had walked into a hothouse, except there were no exotic flowers or butterflies here, just vats of steaming clothes and the pungent stench of bodies that worked too hard and went too long between baths. She glanced around the room, relieved to see she did not recognise anyone. She picked up a pair of tongs and pulled a man's jacket out of the boiling water. She scanned the lapels to check that all dubious-looking stains had been removed, then dipped the garment into the vat of cold water. An old woman sidled up to her, her front teeth missing, her hair almost white except for her yellow fringe, which evidently bore the brunt of her cigarette habit.
"Not seen you here before."
Amy fed the jacket into the mangle. "So?" She was in no mood for small talk.
"All right," said the old woman. "I was only making conversation."
She reached into the boiling vat with her bare hands.
"What on earth are you doing? Here!"
said Amy, quickly brandishing the laundry tongs.
"Use these!"
"When you've worked here as long as I have, you've no need for fancy gadgets like that."
Amy stared as she pulled out a pair of trousers. The woman's hands were bright red, the skin as thick and crinkly as an elephant's.
"Lord above," she thought. "I need to get out of this place."
The hands on the wall clock seemed to have gone on strike as the time passed agonizingly slowly. She was amazed she hadn't given herself away, the amount of time she must have glanced up at the clock, until mercifully it was time for her to make a move. With trembling hands, she untied her apron, her mouth thick and dry, the apprehension making her fuzzy-headed. 3 times she took a deep breath in through her nose and exhaled slowly through her mouth. The adrenaline had kicked in now, and she was eager to get it over with. The time had come to begin the rest of her life. Today, she would be reborn. She called to the old woman, who was now elbow deep in the scalding water.
"I'm just going to the bathroom."
She didn't wait for an answer, but instead skipped through the door and into the blessed cool air of the corridor. She moved as quickly as she dared, not wanting to arouse suspicion, but desperate to leave this miserable place behind. She kept her head down as she marched purposefully along the corridors, not too fast, but quickly enough to deter others from striking up a conversation. Slightly disorientated, she pushed open the double doors and stepped out into the sunshine. She gathered her bearings. She could see the cricket field and the main driveway beyond, a little further away than she had hoped. It shouldn't matter, though. Ed would wait. Better for her to do things carefully than to rush and end up being caught. She sauntered around the edge of the field, stopping every now and again to pick up a daisy or to simply turn her face up to the sun. Anybody watching from the window would hardly suspect she was about to become a fugitive. As the main gate came into view, it was all she could do to stop herself breaking into a run. Her heart was pounding so hard she thought it might actually explode. She calculated she had about 100 steps to go before she would be free. She began to count them off in her head. 99, 98. She thought about her mother, her beautiful, talented mother, who had smothered her with affection. There was no way she would have allowed her to languish in this place. It was her mother who had patiently taught her to read and write during the war years they had spent in Wales, who had taught her to sketch, make Welsh cakes, curl her hair, embroider handkerchiefs. How different things would have been if she'd not died so tragically. 65, 64. Amy clenched her fists when she thought about her father. What a weak man he had turned out to be, in the thrall of a much younger woman who had flattered him and given him the baby he should have had with her mother. 32, 31. Her eyes misted over when she thought of Dr. Lamborne. She refused to believe he had simply abandoned her. They had shared too much for that to be the case, not just physically, but emotionally too. But now she was almost free, and when she found him again, she would give him the chance to explain his actions. She would not get hysterical, and he would see they belonged together. 15, 14. She was within touching distance of the tall brick pillar at the side of the gate now, and she resisted the urge to look over her shoulder. She'd miscalculated the number, but no matter, she was within a few euphoric steps of freedom. She rounded the pillar, giving a gasp of relief, and only then quickened her pace, a broad smile splitting her face. Her cry of joy turned to shock as her foot caught on something and she stumbled, falling headlong onto the pavement. It took her a few seconds to realize what had happened. She rolled onto her side and inspected her palms. The heels of her hands were blood-streaked and ingrained with grit. She winced and rubbed them together just as a dark shadow blocked out the sun. She glanced up at the figure standing over her, arms akimbo.
"And where do you think you're going?"
Chapter 38. She squinted up at the sneering face of Sister Atkins, her red lips curled into a spiteful smile.
"Did you really think you could get away with this?"
She kicked at Amy's legs.
"Get up!"
Amy rose to her feet. Her knees were scuffed raw and a trickle of blood ran down one leg. Her left elbow was bruised and she cradled it in her right hand.
How did you know?"
she whispered.
"As if I'm going to reveal my sources to you."
Sister Atkins grabbed her roughly by the arm and frog-marched her back up the main driveway. With her free hand, she rubbed her chin like a cartoon villain.
"How will I punish you, I wonder? I'm going to have to get my thinking cap on and come up with something really creative."
She finished with a manic cackle, but Amy stared impassively ahead, refusing to supply the reaction Sister so obviously craved. Back on the ward, preparations for lunch had begun. Belinda was helping by spreading the marge on a huge mound of thick white bread. She didn't look up as Amy entered the ward, instead concentrating on the bread as though it was the most fascinating thing she'd ever encountered. Amy inspected her own bicep, rubbing gently at the bruised flesh. She could see the imprint of Sister Atkins' bony fingers and could feel the heat of bitter anger rising up through her gut until it settled in the back of her throat, threatening to choke her. She approached the table where Belinda was working and took a swipe at the tower of bread. It toppled over, several slices falling to the floor.
"Aye," said Belinda. "What do you think?"
"Oh, it's you. How was the laundry?"
Her voice was steady enough, but her eyes were shifty, narrow slits, and she fought to keep her trembling hands still.
"I'm going to get you back for this," Amy hissed. "Just when you're least expecting it, you're going to have to spend the rest of your life in here, looking over your shoulder, and one day I'll be there, your worst nightmare come true."
She lowered her voice and leaned into Belinda, their noses almost touching.
"Revenge is a dish best served cold, don't they say?"
Belinda stayed silent, her eyes now round with fear as she wiped Amy's spittle off her cheek.
I don't know what you mean,"
she protested. But Amy had already turned away, leaving Belinda staring open-mouthed at her retreating figure. She stooped to collect the slices of bread that had fallen to the floor, blew off the bits of fluff and dust, and returned them to the pile. Amy lay on top of her bed, a damp towel across her forehead. She closed her eyes and tried to picture Ed waiting for her in the bus shelter, clutching the bundle of clothes. How many times must he have looked at his watch and gazed down the street, willing her to come round the corner? He had taken a huge risk for her, and she'd let him down. Perhaps he thought she'd changed her mind and didn't want to leave Ambergate after all. She looked towards Sister's office, wondering what the vile nurse had in store for her. She propped herself up on her elbows and wiped the towel over her face. It didn't matter. They wouldn't break her, she decided. Resilient was what Belinda had called her, and she was right. She would not be brutalized into submission. If Sister Atkins wanted a battle, she could have it, and there would only be one winner. Later, as dusk fell, Amy sat with her book by the open window in the day room, allowing the cool breeze to waft over her face. She absently turned the page, her eyes seeing the words, but her distracted brain unable to make any sense of them. Making her wait for the axe to fall was no doubt all part of Sister's plan to prolong the torture. Belinda wandered in carrying a mug from which she took slow, deliberate sips.
This cocoa's delicious. Sister gave it to me as a treat for being such a good girl.
Why did you do it, Belinda? Belinda wiped her hand across her mouth and gave an almost imperceptible shake of her head.
I've never had a friend before. Not in here nor out there.
She gestured towards the window.
Nobody's ever liked me for just being me. They've always wanted something from me. You made me see that, Amy. You made me see that I was worth more than that.
Amy kept her voice level. I'm glad you think of me as a friend, Belinda, but I didn't deserve that kind of treachery. Friends don't snitch on one another.
But I didn't want you to leave.
What about what I want? Belinda shrugged.
I thought you liked me.
Well, you know what thought did. Amy returned to her book, savagely flipping over the next page. Get lost, Belinda, and don't talk to me again! Belinda drained the last of her cocoa and slammed the mug down on the table.
You stuck-up cow. You've always thought you were better than the rest of us, haven't you? Well, I've got news for you. You're just like everyone else. Your dad bundled you in here the same as mine did. And no wonder that doctor scarpered. He'd probably had enough of your whining to last him a lifetime.
Amy swallowed hard, breathing through her nose like an enraged bull about to charge. She slipped her hand down the side of the cushion and groped for the zip. Without taking her eyes off Belinda, she unzipped a gap big enough to get her fingers in. She felt around the foam cushion, prodding the spongy slab until she alighted on what she was looking for. Slowly she withdrew the pointed sliver of china and encased it in her palm, with the sleight of hand a magician would be proud of. Belinda stood over her now, her hands planted on her hips. She evidently had more to get off her chest.
"And why that sweet young boy would want anything to do with such a..."
Amy rose from her seat, her right hand behind her back. She stared into Belinda's face, her spiteful, mocking tone inviting a response. Then she smiled, brought her hand up, and plunged the shard of china into Belinda's neck. A ribbon of blood arced in front of Amy's face, and Belinda fell to the floor. Chapter 39. She lay in the corner of the room, wedged into the angle where the walls met the floor, her cheek pressed into the cold rubber matting, and her body curled up like a hibernating hedgehog. She stretched her limbs out one by one and turned onto her back, feeling along the thick walls, spongy walls, smooth to the touch. Her finger found a small hole, and she dug her nail in and scooped out a chunk of coarse hair. She struggled into a sitting position and rubbed the back of her neck. Her hair was brittle and reeked of the acidic tang of vomit. She glanced over to the steel door, painted gunmetal grey with a tiny square in the middle. Her stomach felt hollow, as though someone had released a valve and deflated her body. A clang of metal and a squeaking hinge drew her attention back to the door. The small square opened and a pair of wide eyes peered in.
"Morning, Amy. I'm coming in now, so no funny business, if you don't mind."
Nurse Ellen Crosby heaved open the door and reattached the bunch of jangling keys to her belt. She thrust a tray towards Amy.
"I've brought you some porridge."
She glanced at the open door behind her before digging into her pocket.
"I've managed to procure a packet of sugar, too. Thought it might make the porridge a little more palatable. You've not been eating much, you know."
Amy peeled her tongue from the roof of her furred-up mouth.
"Water," she croaked. "I need a glass of water."
Ellen nodded at the tray.
"It's here in this plastic beaker."
She crouched down next to Amy and held the cup to her lips, watching as Amy drained it.
"You were thirsty."
Amy groaned as she stretched her arms.
"I'm so stiff. What's happened? Where am I?"
With another nervous glance towards the door, Ellen dropped her voice and spoke in hushed tones.
"How much do you remember?"
Amy tried to run her fingers through her sticky hair. She screwed up her eyes and willed her brain to provide a memory.
"I was outside,"
she began, her voice hoarse and scratchy.
"It was warm and I was happy, I think. Excited. I was going to meet someone."
The fog in her memory shifted slightly.
"Yes, that's it. I was going to meet Dr. Lamborn. He sent for me. I knew he would."
She tried to get to her feet.
"I need to go and see him now. He'll be waiting. Please help me up, will you, nurse?"
Ellen placed her hand on Amy's shoulder and pressed down.
"You're not going anywhere just yet, Amy. Please, I need to get cleaned up. He can't see me like this."
She grabbed hold of Ellen's wrist, startling the young nurse. Amy laughed.
"It's all right. I'm not going to hurt you. Now, when can I have a bath?"
She grabbed a fistful of her nightdress and stuffed it under her nose.
"And I'm going to need a change of clothes. Dr. Lamborn doesn't work here anymore, Amy." "I know that. I'm not stupid. He's waiting for me on the outside."
Ellen shook her head.
"No, he's not. You're still a certified patient. And after what happened with Belinda, you're likely to remain so for quite some time, I'm afraid."
Amy stared at her vacantly.
"Who's Belinda?"
Are you serious?
Amy didn't answer, just clutched at her stomach as another wave of nausea overcame her. As she heaved, the bile stung her throat, and the cup of water she'd drunk moments before was expelled over the breakfast tray. Ellen took a startled step back.
Oh, no, not again. You've been like this every morning for the past week.
The past week? Amy clarified. But I only came in here last night. What are you talking about? Ellen shook her head.
You've been out of it most of the time. You know, sedated.
She seemed uncomfortable.
I mean, we had no choice. You were extremely violent and volatile. Belinda was lucky to survive. It was fortunate that every morning...
Amy interrupted.
I'm sorry? You said I've been sick every morning.
Ellen nodded slowly.
That's right.
Amy gazed down at her stomach and smoothed out the nightdress, her hand resting on the almost imperceptible swell of her belly.
Oh.
The word came out on a breath of disbelief.
Oh, my God.
She looked up at Ellen and smiled.
I'm having Dr. Lamborn's baby.
After leaving Amy's padded cell, Ellen scuttled back to the ward, desperate to find Sister Atkins and tell her this unbelievable news. She cursed the sheer scale of the place with its never-ending corridors and numerous sets of doors to navigate. Arriving breathless on the ward, she found Sister Atkins ensconced in her office, listening to a play on the radio, her eyes closed and her feet up on the desk.
Sister Atkins, I...
Sister held up her hand but didn't open her eyes.
Shh, not now. But are you deaf or just stupid?
Neither, I...
Out!
Ellen hovered in the doorway, biting at her thumbnail.
It's important, Sister Atkins. I wouldn't bother you ordinarily, but it concerns Amy.
Sister Atkins groaned.
Oh, I might have bloody known she'd be involved somehow. She's no longer a patient on this ward, and yet here we are, still talking about her.
She took her legs off the desk, switched off the radio, and indicated the chair opposite. Ellen sat down gratefully.
I've just taken her some breakfast. I wanted to see how she was this morning. I've always felt a kind of affinity with her, as you know. We both came to Ambergate at the same time, we're the same age.
Can you get to the point, please, Student Nurse Crosby?
Of course. Well, this morning, she was a little more alert. She's been sedated since the attack on Belinda and can't seem to remember anything about it.
That's not so unusual, and certainly not important enough for you to disturb me on my break.
Ellen shook her head.
No, that's not why I'm here. I'll come straight to the point.
Sister Atkins glanced at the ceiling.
Hallelujah!
She lit a cigarette, sucking long and hard. Ellen leaned forward in her chair and lowered her voice.
Amy says she's pregnant.
Sister Atkins stared impassively ahead, her expression difficult to read. She tapped some ash into her saucer.
Pregnant?
Ellen nodded.
That's what she says.
And how is that possible?
I'm not sure, but she says the baby's Dr. Lamborn's.
Sister Atkins guffawed so loudly, Ellen jumped in alarm.
Ha! I've heard it all now. E, that takes the biscuit, that does.
Why would she lie about a thing like that?
Simple. The girl's deluded. She's a certified loony, for God's sake. You don't even have to take my word for it. I've got the bloody paperwork.
But I really think she may be telling the truth. I think she might be pregnant.
Sister Atkins seemed unperturbed by this.
In the highly unlikely event that that is the case, I can assure you that Dr. Lamborn is definitely not the father.
I know it sounds incredible, but he was rather fond of her.
You think he'd risk his career for a fling with a silly little girl like that?
Ellen shrugged.
Well, why would she say it?
She's hardly a credible witness. No, if she's pregnant, then my money's on that young lad she was planning on running off with. That makes more sense.
I suppose so, but...
Sister Atkins cut her off.
Shut the door.
Ellen frowned, but did as she was asked and returned to her seat.
You've heard of mumps, Student Nurse Crosby.
Obviously, but what's that got to do with anything?
Sister Atkins stubbed out her cigarette.
I'm going to nip this in the bud, but it stays within these four walls, do you understand?
Ellen nodded.
Whatever you say, sister.
Good.
Sister Atkins clasped her hands and laid them on her desk, adopting a reverential tone. When Dr. Lambourne was a teenager, he contracted mumps, which rendered him infertile.
She waited for her words to sink in before continuing. Have you ever wondered why such a good-looking, successful man of 30 is unmarried?
No, I can't say I've ever given it much thought, to be honest.
Well, he was engaged once, a few years ago, but when his fiancée found out he couldn't have children, she upped and left.
How awful for him.
Indeed. So, you see, whatever Amy Sullivan says, Dr. Lambourne cannot possibly be the father of her child.
Chapter 40. The morning air was cold and sharp, and it felt good to take in an invigorating lungful. Amy picked her way along the frost-encrusted lawn, taking care not to slip on the layers of rotting leaves beneath her feet. When she reached the cricket pavilion, she grabbed the handrail and gingerly mounted the wooden steps. Out of breath, she settled down on the bench seat and rubbed her hand over the large dome of her belly, her coat buttons straining over the bump. For the past 2 days, she'd suffered from a dull backache and the familiar dragging sensation she normally associated with her time of the month. She knew it wouldn't be long now. Soon she would be able to hold Dr. Lambourne's baby in her arms, and then they would have no choice but to let her out. A baby needed its father as well as its mother. The last 6 months had slipped by in a blur of white padded walls, calming drugs that stupefied her to the point of submission, and long days spent staring at the ceiling with only foggy, distorted memories for company. Dr. Lambourne's face was clear enough, though. She could still picture his dark eyes and his even white teeth standing out against his olive skin, which always seemed to sport a smattering of stubble. She pulled the handkerchief out of her pocket, the one he had given her all those months ago, and held it against her nose. The familiar smell of his cologne fading now, but still just about detectable, transported her back to their sessions in his office, a place where she'd been able to relax and allow him to coax her demons out. She turned around and squinted through the glass into the pavilion, shielding her eyes from the reflection. An old mildewed sofa was wedged against the wall, its stuffing spilling out over the wooden floor, which was speckled with mouse droppings. She frowned as a memory came unbidden, a flash of a smile, a warm brown hand in hers, and a thigh pressed against her own. She turned the handle of the door, and after some gentle persuasion it creaked open. The air was dank and musty, and a spider's web caught in her hair as she crossed the threshold. She felt she'd been inside here before, but her opaque memory refused to surrender a clear image. She ran her hand along the sofa, the pile worn down to the bare wefts of thread. She rubbed her temples and squeezed her eyes closed, willing herself to remember. A name. Edward.
Ed?
From nowhere, a band of pain gripped her round her middle, and she emitted a high-pitched shriek, which startled a mouse and sent it scuttling across the floor. She lowered herself onto the battered sofa and breathed deeply as another wave of pain exerted its iron grip. The baby was coming.
"No," she whispered. "Not here. Not now."
She struggled to her feet, her hand resting in the small of her back, and her heart pumping wildly. She descended the slippery steps and waddled towards the main building as quickly as her cumbersome frame would allow.
"Please, please,"
she begged, although she had no idea who she was pleading with. She stopped as another excruciating wave sliced through her abdomen, causing her body to fold over. The blood rushed to her head, and despite the arctic chill, the back of her neck was pasted with sweat. When the pain had passed, she straightened up and staggered forward again, each treacherous step fraught with danger on the frosted grass. Hot tears scorched her frigid cheeks as she battled to stay upright, but she knew, deep down, that it was a battle she couldn't win. Panic grasped her by the throat,
its bony fingers squeezing her airway until the blackness descended as though someone had thrown a cloak over her body. She slumped to the ground, her head hitting the solid turf with a sickening thud. Somebody had hold of her hand. Someone else was soothing her brow as she twisted her head from side to side. The light above the bed was dazzlingly bright, the sheets cool and clammy, and the clatter of instruments too loud in her ears. The metallic tang of blood hovered in the air. Every one of her senses was being assaulted. She raised her head off the pillow and let out a long groan. A nurse she had never seen before was asking her to push hard. Push what? She had no idea what she was talking about. She lolled back on the pillow.
What's happening? Where am I?
A voice she did recognize spoke calmly into her ear.
It's Nurse Crosby here, Amy. You're in a special room in the hospital. Me and the midwife, Sister Brown, are going to look after you. You're having your baby, remember?
There was no time to formulate a response before another contraction violated her body.
Ah! It hurts! It's too much, please! I need...
The pain subsided again, and she lay panting, white foam gathering in the corners of her mouth.
I need some water, she croaked.
Ellen pressed a glass to her lips and Amy took a grateful sip.
You're doing very well,
the nurse encouraged.
It's taking rather a long time, but we're nearly there now. Just a couple more pushes and it'll all be over.
Amy gazed down between her open legs to the midwife, who was crouching at the end of the bed.
How much longer?
She pleaded. Sister Brown looked up, a slight frown on her ruddy face. Her hand was plunged deep inside Amy's body.
You can't rush these things.
You were lucky, added Ellen. Your waters broke out on the field. It was a miracle that you were found in time and brought inside. Nurse Crosby. The midwife's voice was light, but her face wore a worried expression. Can you come down this end for a minute? Ellen placed a reassuring hand on Amy's head. Everything will be fine. Sister Brown spoke in hushed, hurried tones.
Something's not right. I think the cord is round the baby's neck. On the next contraction, I expect the head to be delivered. I need you to hook your finger under the cord and wrestle it free. Do you think you can manage that?
Ellen swallowed hard and panted out a few short breaths as though she herself was in labour.
I hope so.
The midwife spoke to Amy.
Right, on the next contraction, I need you to push long and hard. Keep going until I tell you to stop.
Ellen stared in awe as the baby's head crowned. Then its puckered-up little face appeared, bearing an angry expression, its neck wrapped in the pulsing umbilical cord. Sister Brown cradled the baby's head.
Now!
She commanded. Ellen loosened the cord, slimy beneath her trembling fingers, and with the next contraction the little blue body slithered out. Sister Brown turned it over and slapped the baby's back with much more force than Ellen thought was necessary. Then she began rubbing it as though she was kneading dough. Ellen hovered at the end of the bed, horrified by the sight of the ragged little body, yet unable to tear her gaze away.
Is he going to be all right?
The midwife ignored the question but carried on rubbing, her whole body shaking with the effort. At last she stopped, shook her head and crossed herself. She looked up at Ellen.
I did my best, but it took too long.
Ellen gazed down at the perfectly formed little boy.
You don't mean... What? What's happening?
Gasped Amy, propping herself up on her elbows.
Where's my baby?
Ellen took hold of Amy's hand, fighting back tears.
I'm really sorry, Amy, but he didn't make it. The cord was...
Amy screamed, a long primeval howl that echoed off the tiled walls.
No! 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 You're wrong!
Let me see my son. He can't be dead. He can't be. I love him.
Choking on her sobs, she reached out her arms.
Give him to me,
she demanded. Sister Brown shook her head. I wouldn't recommend it. She thrust the wrapped bundle towards Ellen. You know what to do.
No!
Amy was frantic now, flinging off the thin sheet that covered her knees and attempting to get up.
Let me see my baby! He can't be dead! He's all I've got left! I'm warning you! When Dr. Lambourn finds out that you wouldn't let me see our baby, he'll...
The midwife pressed her down. You're not finished here yet. You need to deliver the afterbirth. I'm really sorry about your baby, but sometimes these things happen. She nodded at Ellen, not bothering to hide her impatience. Take him to the morgue. Chapter 41. September 2006. It was dark by the time Sarah arrived home. She unlocked the front door and called out to her father as she entered the hall.
Sorry I'm late, Dad. Have you had anything to eat?
She popped her head round the lounge door. He was sitting in his favourite armchair, the newspaper spread out on his lap.
Yes, I've done roast beef. I've left you a plateful in the microwave.
Great, thanks.
I've even managed to make some Yorkshire puddings. Followed your mother's recipe and they turned out a treat.
She returned with her food on a tray and settled down in the chair opposite.
I'm ravenous.
She shoved a forkful into her mouth. It's been a busy day. He raised his eyebrows.
How's the research coming along, then?
She stopped chewing and set her knife and fork down. It was the first time he had shown any interest in the project. She swallowed and wiped her serviette over her mouth.
Really well, since you ask.
He nodded slowly.
Good, I'm glad.
He returned to his newspaper. Dad, she began. He peered at her over his spectacles.
Yes.
You do know I'm only writing a book about Ambergate because you were there.
So I gather.
She shuffled forward, the tray balanced precariously on her knees. I was really hoping you would help me, give me some insight into the daily life of the patients. It would make the book so much more authentic. When he didn't put up any resistance, she ploughed on. It's such an important part of our social history. The people who spent time there deserve to have their stories heard. He stayed silent and she warmed to her theme. With your help, I could give them a voice. She paused for effect. I could give you a voice too, Dad. Your contribution would be invaluable. He let his head loll back on the chair and stared at the ceiling.
I don't know, Sarah. It's all such a long time ago.
What's that got to do with anything? People still like to read about the Battle of Hastings. He laughed.
I can't argue with that logic.
She joined her hands into the praying position.
Please, Dad.
She was aware she sounded like a mithering toddler. He shook his head.
I don't know, Sarah. I
found something today that might make you change your mind.
Oh, and what was that?
She chewed on her bottom lip, mulling over how much she should tell him.
We found some suitcases.
Suitcases?
Yes, in an attic space.
Who's we?
Oh, me and this young lad, Nathan. He's a homeless guy who sleeps there sometimes.
Sleeps in a derelict asylum?
Her father shuddered.
Rather him than me.
Yes, quite. Anyway, there's a pile of suitcases up there. About 20 of them in total. We've been documenting the contents and taking photographs. That's why I've been so long. He folded up his newspaper and dropped it onto the carpet.
Anything interesting?
She hesitated.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact.
Oh?
Come with me, Dad. Come with me to Ambergate tomorrow and I'll show you.
He shook his head.
Oh, no, Sarah, I'm not setting foot in that place again.
Why not, Dad? What happened in there?
Let's just say it's a part of my life I would rather forget about.
She stood up, set the tray on the floor and reached into the back pocket of her jeans. She pulled out the note she had found in the suitcase and ran her fingers along the fold. Tentatively, she opened it out and passed it over to her father. He shook his head and put his hand up.
No, I don't want to be involved, Sarah. Whatever it is, take it away.
She took the note back and blew out an exasperated breath. All right, then, as you wish. She picked up the tray and headed for the kitchen.
Do you want a brew?
He looked at his watch for no apparent reason.
Aye, go on then.
Later, unable to sleep, she flicked on the bedside light. The duvet was knotted into a tight ball, and she struggled to unfurl it. She swung her legs out of bed and perched on the side, then reached for her camera and began to scroll through the photographs once more, her heart quickening at the sight of the treasures she had uncovered. Nothing of any tangible value, but a whole host of interesting memorabilia. And, of course, the note. She felt around under her pillow and pulled out the creamy piece of paper. Unfolding it, she read the first four words in a hushed whisper.
Your baby didn't die.
Chapter 42. The library was deserted at this time of the morning. Most of the staff had yet to heave themselves out of bed, and the place was eerily quiet, with only the hum of the low-level lighting breaking the silence. Sarah hung her coat on the back of the staff room door and flicked the switch on the kettle, a routine she had carried out every day since she started work here 5 years ago. She supervised the reference library upstairs, her dedication to local history having been instrumental in getting her the job. She'd written on all sorts of subjects for the local papers and parish magazines, and her features were in demand. Even though the pay was pitiful, sometimes non-existent, she still gained a huge sense of pride at seeing her work in print. Her history of Ambergate was her biggest project to date, though, one that she intended to dedicate to her father. She poured hot water onto the peppermint tea bag and carried it over to the computer, fumbling around under the desk to switch the machine on. Once it had burst into life and she'd entered the password, she opened her notebook. She found the name and typed it into the search bar. There were over 10,000 results, but she selected the first one, an online encyclopedia. Millie McCarthy, 6th of November 1916 to 1st of September 1947. Millie McCarthy was an English artist. She was born in Salford and dedicated her career to painting landscapes. The source of her inspiration came from the Pembrokeshire coast, where she spent the war years as a virtual recluse with only her young daughter for company. Such was her talent, she came to the attention of L.S. Lowry, who bought two of her paintings, calling her an exceptionally gifted artist. She was tragically killed in a motor accident on the 1st of September 1947. Sarah leaned back in her chair, frowning. She stared at the accompanying photograph. It was black and white and showed Millie sitting beside her easel, a paintbrush in her hand, and her head thrown back in the throes of laughter. She looked happy, radiant even. But there was no mention of her ever being in Ambergate. Sarah pressed another couple of buttons, and the printer whirred into life, spitting out a copy of the entry. Over the noise of the printer, she heard the front door rattling below, followed by a hesitant knock on the glass. She hurried downstairs and stared at the two vaguely familiar figures on the other side as she unlocked the door. "Story time's not until 9, she said, glancing at the clock on the wall. He was apologetic, but the pleading look in his eyes pointed to his desperation. He clutched his daughter's hand.
"I'm really sorry, but could you take her for half an hour?"
He smoothed his hand over the top of the little girl's head. "I've got a conference call with my Hong Kong partners." "Can't she wait in your office with you?"
"She doesn't want to miss the start of story time."
"Well, I don't know," Sarah stammered. "I don't think we're insured for this kind of thing. Annie's not in until 2:15.
"She'll be no trouble."
He crouched down and kissed his daughter on the forehead.
You'll be a good girl, won't you, Maisie?
The little girl nodded.
Yes, Daddy, I promise.
He raised his eyebrows expectantly, bouncing from one foot to the other as he waited for her reply. He was easy on the eye, as her mother used to say, his strong jaws speckled with 5 o'clock shadow, his black hair swept away from his forehead and given an extra sheen with the addition of some sort of gel. Go on, then, Sarah relented, opening the door further. It must be important if he was having to make calls on a Saturday morning. He touched her forearm.
Thank you, you're a lifesaver.
And you are prone to exaggeration.
She tapped her watch. Try to be back at 9:30 if you can. I don't want my boss thinking I've opened some sort of free-for-all creche. He winked at her.
Now who's exaggerating?
She laughed.
See you later.
She watched as he jogged off down the path, then stopped and turned.
My name's Matt, by the way.
Maisie stood clutching her Dora the Explorer rucksack. Her fine blonde hair had been clumsily styled into a French plait, wispy loose ends escaping the confines of the bobble.
Shall we go over and sit on the beanbags in Story Corner?
Maisie nodded and skipped off.
Can I choose the story today?
Sarah followed her.
Well, that's not up to me, but I'll have a word with Annie, see what she says. I don't work down here, you see. I work upstairs with the grown-up books. Would you like a drink?
She mentally ran through the contents of the kitchen cupboard. Tea, coffee, a bottle of single malt whiskey they kept for really stressful days.
How about a glass of milk?
Maisie grinned.
Chocolate milkshake?
No, not chocolate milkshake. This is a library, not McDonald's.
Maisie giggled.
You're funny.
She snuggled down on the beanbag and opened a large picture book.
Okay, I'll just have the white milk then.
Sarah returned with the glass and a custard cream and placed them next to Maisie on the table.
Thank you.
Maisie took a long glug of the milk, leaving a white moustache across her top lip.
What's your name?
It's Sarah.
Can you do my French plait again? Daddy's not very good at them and it's all come loose.
She pulled her face and tugged the bobble out.
Here.
Sarah took the bobble.
I don't know how to do a French plait, I'm afraid. Will a plain English one do?
Maisie considered this.
Like Rapunzel, you mean?
Well, yes, I guess I could manage that.
Maisie rummaged in her rucksack and pulled out a hairbrush.
Gently, please.
Sarah ran the brush through the little girl's blonde locks, careful not to tug at the knots.
Can your mummy not do French plaits, then?
Maisie turned the page of the book and replied without looking up.
I don't have a mummy. She died.
Sarah stopped brushing and took a step backwards.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry. I hope I haven't upset you.
She was poorly and she had no hair.
Sarah swallowed and glanced towards the door. She didn't want Matt bursting in on them in the middle of such a delicate conversation.
You poor little mite.
She died when I was nearly 4,
Maisie added matter-of-factly.
And how old are you now?
5 and a bit.
Maisie picked up the biscuit and separated the two halves, scraping out the sickly yellow filling with her teeth. Sarah noticed the little girl's sparkly nails and seized the chance to change the subject.
I like your nail polish.
Daddy put it on for me. He's not very good at hair, but he's good at painting nails.
Sarah separated Maisie's hair into 3 strands and began to overlap them.
That's nice. What else is he good at?
Well, he's quite good at cooking. My favourite is hoops on toast.
Good Lord, I hope that's not the extent of his culinary skills.
Maisie turned round and stared at her.
I don't know big words.
Sarah laughed as she came to the end of the plait and secured it with the bobble.
You're so sweet, Maisie.
She patted her shoulder. All done. Now, let's go and choose a story, shall we? She was upstairs in the reference library, her back to the door when Matt bounded into the room. The armful of books she was carrying slid to the floor.
I'm so sorry it took longer than I expected. Sarah patted her chest. Oh, you startled me. He bent down and scooped up the books. Sorry, he said again. How was she? Sarah smiled. She's adorable. Matt beamed and held his arms out wide. What can I say? She's my life. Well, she's a credit to you. We usually go to the park after story time. You know how kids like routine. Sarah nodded, even though she had no idea what kids liked or didn't like. That's nice. She glanced out of the window. It looks gorgeous out there. Very warm, too. Perhaps we're in for an Indian summer. He loosened his collar to let in some air. Would you like to come with us? She hesitated for a moment, feeling ridiculously excited at the prospect of spending some time with him. I would like that, yes, thank you. He clapped his hands together. Great! I'll just go and tell Maisie. It was her idea. They sat side by side on a bench as they watched Maisie climb the slide. Sarah took a bite out of her flake. Thanks for the ice cream. You're welcome. It's the least I could do after you helped me out this morning. Maisie called from the top of the slide, waving her arms in the air.
Daddy, look at me!
Matt was on his feet in an instant. Sit down, Maisie, and hold on to the sides. He shook his head and returned to the bench. She's fearless, that one. Sarah glanced down at Matt's wedding ring. Maisie told me about her mummy. Matt attempted a smile. I'm not surprised. She talks about her mummy in heaven as though Lucy has just popped out to the shops. She knows Lucy's not coming back, though. I've had to be clear about that. It's hard, but she understands. She sounds very resilient. Yep, she keeps me going. Gives me a reason to carry on when it would all be too easy to spend the day under the duvet. I'm really sorry. It must be tough. Matt shrugged. It is, but what I'm going through is nothing compared to what Lucy suffered. At least I'll get to see Maisie grow up. I was there on her first day at school. I'll get to see her graduate, give her away on her wedding day. He faltered, took a deep breath and turned to look at Sarah. I'm sorry. You've got nothing to apologise for, Matt. It's important to talk. Bottling stuff up never did anybody any good. You're so right. When Lucy died, all I wanted to do was talk about her, but that made everybody else around me feel uncomfortable, so I stopped mentioning her. I put other people's feelings above my own because I didn't want to upset them. They both fell silent as Maisie ran over to the bench, her cheeks tinged pink.
Daddy, will you push me on the swing?
He jumped up immediately. Of course I will, darling. Off you go, I'll catch you up. He turned to Sarah. Duty calls. She watched as he ran after his daughter, his brown corduroy jacket with reinforced elbow patches flapping in the breeze. Anybody else would look like an aging university professor in that garb, but Matt carried it off with effortless chic. Maisie scrambled onto the swing and Matt made sure she was holding on before he pushed her gently.
Hiya, Daddy!
She implored. Matt shook his head and glanced at Sarah. See? Fearless. After 5 minutes, Maisie was ready to get off.
Catch me, Daddy!
Matt moved round to the front of the swing, and as she slowed down, Maisie jumped off into her father's arms. He held her high in the air, spun her round, then buried his face in her neck, making her squeal as he covered her in kisses. Sarah watched on, their tender exchange making her smile outwardly, but inside she ached for everything they had lost. She was up in her bedroom when her father tapped on the door later that evening.
Come in.
He shuffled into the room.
I've brought you some hot chocolate.
She couldn't help her surprise.
Oh, right, thanks. It's got that squirty cream and marshmallows on, the full Monty.
She took the mug. What have I done to deserve this? He sat down next to her on the bed.
Yesterday, when I asked you about moving out...
She picked a marshmallow off the top and popped it into her mouth. Hmm? What about it?
Well, I don't want you to think you're not welcome here. Of course you are. You can stay as long as you need to.
Thanks.
But I'll be all right, you know. You don't need to stay on my account.
I know you mean well, Dad. And I will go home soon, I promise. She glanced around her childhood bedroom with its woodchip papered walls, painted in oranges and browns, her bright yellow eiderdown, the old rocking horse in the corner. She'd brushed that horse's flaxen mane so much that it was now almost bald. Even her poster of David Cassidy still hung over the headboard. The whole room might have been a throwback to the 70s, but she felt safe here. It was her haven. She closed the lid of her laptop and began to gather her notes, which were spread across the bed. Her father picked up the entry she had printed out at the library and squinted at it, the paper quivering in his fingers as he absorbed the information.
What are you doing with this?
She took the sheet from him and put it in her bag. Oh, it's to do with my research. I found a painting in one of those suitcases I told you about. Millie McCarthy was the artist. I thought it might provide a clue as to why she was in Ambergate, but it seems... He cut her off.
Was